Disc 5.
Well, maybe if you did, you wouldn't spend so many evenings alone. I hadn't thought about that. Did the Smithsonian tell you where we was going to park up there? Because there's no parking in D.C.
Nowhere in the entire district? The president should do something about that. We were inside my kitchen, and the sun was gold on windows facing it, while the southern exposure caught the river glinting through trees. I had slept better last night, although I had no idea why, unless my brain had been so overloaded it simply had died. I remembered no dreams and was grateful.
I got a couple of VIP parking passes from the last time Clinton was in town, Marino said, helping himself to coffee. Issued by the mayor's office. He poured coffee for me, too, and slid the mug my way like a mug of beer on the bar. I figured with your Benz and those, maybe the cops would think we have diplomatic immunity or something, he went on.
I'm supposing you've seen the boots they put on cars up there.
I sliced a poppy seed bagel, then opened the refrigerator door to take an inventory. I've got Swiss, Vermont cheddar, prosciutto. I opened another plastic drawer. And Parmesan Reggiano, that wouldn't be very good. No cream cheese, sorry. But I think I've got honey if you'd rather have that.
What about a Vidalia onion? He asked, looking over my shoulder.
That I have. Swiss, prosciutto, and a slice of onion is just what the doctor ordered, Marino happily said. Now that's what I call a breakfast.
No butter, I told him. I have to draw the line somewhere so I don't feel responsible for your sudden death.
Deli mustard would be good, he said.
I spread spicy yellow mustard, then added prosciutto and onion with the cheese on top, and by the time the toaster oven had heated up, I was consumed by cravings. I fixed the same concoction for myself and poured my granola back into its tin. We sat at my simple maple kitchen table and drank Colombian coffee and ate, while sunlight painted the flowers in my yard in vibrant hues and the sky turned a brilliant blue. We were on I-95 North by 9:30 and fought little traffic until Quantico. As I drove past the exit for the FBI Academy and Marine Corps Base, I was tugged by days that no longer were, by memories of my relationship with Benton when it was new, and my anxious pride over Lucy's accomplishments in a law enforcement agency that remained as much a politically correct all-boys club as it had been during the reign of Hoover. Only now the Bureau's prejudices and power-mongering were more covert as it marched forward like an army in the night, capturing jurisdictions and credits wherever it could as it pushed closer to becoming the official federal police force of America. Such realizations had been devastating to me and were largely left unspoken because I did not want to hurt the individual agent in the field who worked hard and had given his heart to what he believed was a noble calling. I could feel Marino looking at me as he tapped an ash out his window.
You know, Doc, he said, maybe you should resign.
He referred to my long-held position as the consulting forensic pathologist for the Bureau.
I know they're using other medical examiners these days, he went on, bringing them on in cases instead of calling you. Let's face it, you haven't been to the academy in over a year, and that's not an accident. They don't want to deal with you because of what they did to Lucy.
I can't resign, I said, because I don't work for them, Marino. I work for cops who need help with their cases and turn to the Bureau. There's no way I'll be the one who quits. And things go in cycles. Directors and attorneys general come and go, and maybe someday things will be better again. Besides, you are still a consultant for them, and they don't seem to call you either.
Yo, well, I guess I feel the same way you do.
He pitched his cigarette butt, and it sailed behind us on the wind of my speeding car.
It sucks, don't it? Going up there and working with good people and drinking beer in the boardroom. It all gets to me, if you want to know. People hating cops and cops hating them back. When I was getting started, old folks, kids, parents, they was happy to see me. I was proud to put on the uniform and shine my shoes every day. Now, after 20 years, I get bricks thrown at me in the projects, and citizens don't even answer if I say good morning. I worked my ass off for 26 years, and they promote me to captain and put me in charge of the training bureau.
That's probably the place where you can do the most good, I reminded him.
Yeah, but that's not why I got stuck there.
He stared out his side window, watching green highway signs fly by.
They're putting me out to pasture, hoping I'll hurry up and retire or die. And I gotta tell you, Doc, I think about it a lot. Taking the boat out, fishing, taking the RV on the road, and maybe going out west to see the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, Lake Tahoe, all those places I've always heard about. But then when it gets right down to it, I wouldn't know what to do with myself. So I just think I'll croak in the saddle.
Not any time soon, I said. And should you retire, Marino, you can do like Benton.
With all due respect, I ain't the consultant type, he said. The Institute of Justice and IBM ain't gonna hire a slob like me. Doesn't matter what I know.
I didn't disagree or offer another word, because with rare exception what he had said was true. Benton was handsome and polished and commanded respect when he walked into a room, and that was really the only difference between him and Pete Marino. Both were honest and compassionate and experts in their fields. All right, we need to pick up 395 and head over to Constitution, I thought out loud as I watched signs and ignored urgent drivers riding my bumper and darting around me because going the speed limit wasn't fast enough. What we don't want to do is go too far and end up on Main Avenue. I've done that before. I flicked on my right turn signal. On a Friday night when I was coming up to see Lucy.
A good way to get carjacked, Marino said.
Almost did.
No shit, he looked over at me. What did you do?
They started circling my car, so I floored it.
Run anybody over?
Almost.
Would you have kept on going, Doc? I mean, if you had run one of them over?
With at least a dozen of his buddies left, you bet your boots.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, he said, looking down at his feet. They ain't worth much.
15 minutes later, we were on Constitution, passing the Department of Interior while the Washington Monument watched over the mall, where tents had been set up to celebrate African-American art, and vendors sold Eastern Shore crabs and T-shirts from the backs of small trucks. The grass between kiosks was depressingly layered with yesterday's trash, and every other minute another ambulance screamed past. We had driven in circles several times, the Smithsonian coiled in the distance like a dark red dragon. There was not a parking place to be found, and typically streets were one way or abruptly stopped in the middle of a block, while others were barricaded, and harried commuters did not yield even if it meant you were running into the back of a parked bus. I tell you what I think we should do, I said, turning on Virginia Avenue. We'll valet park at the Watergate and take a cab.
Who the hell would want to live in a city like this? Marino griped.
Unfortunately, a lot of people.
Talk about a place that's screwed up, he went on. Welcome to America.
The uniformed valet at the Watergate was very gracious and did not seem to think it odd when I gave him my car and asked him to hail a cab. My precious cargo was in the back seat, packed in a sturdy cardboard box filled with styrofoam peanuts. Marino and I were let out at 12th and Constitution at not quite noon and climbed the crowded steps of the National Museum of Natural History. Security had been intensified since the Oklahoma bombing, and the guard let us know that Dr. Vesey would have to come down and escort us upstairs. While we waited, we perused an exhibit called Jewels of the Sea, browsing Atlantic thorny oysters and Pacific lion's paws, while the skull of a duck-billed dinosaur watched us from a wall. There were eels and fish and crabs in jars, and tree snails and a mosasaur marine lizard found in a Kansas chalk bed. Marino was beginning to get bored when the bright brass elevator doors opened and Dr. Alex Vesey stepped out. He had changed little since I had seen him last, still slight of build with white hair and prepossessed eyes that, like those of so many geniuses, were perpetually focused somewhere else. His face was tan and perhaps more lined, and he still wore the same thick, black-framed glasses. "You're looking robust," I said to him as we shook hands.
"I just got back from vacation. Charleston."
"I trust you've been there?" he said, as the three of us boarded the elevator.
"Yes," I replied. "I know the chief there very well. You remember Captain Marino?"
"Of course." We rose 3 levels above the 8-ton African bush elephant in the rotunda, the voices of children floating up like wisps of smoke. The museum was in truth little more than a huge granite warehouse. Some 30,000 human skeletons were stored in green wooden drawers stacked from floor to ceiling. It was a rare collection used to study people of the past, specifically Native Americans, who of late had been determined to get their ancestors' bones back. Laws had been passed, and Vessi had been through hell on the hill, his life's work halfway out the door, and headed back to the not-so-wild West. "We've got a repatriation staff that collects data to supply to this group and that," he was saying as we accompanied him along a crowded, dim corridor. "Respective tribes have to be informed as to what we've got, and it's really up to them to determine what's done. In another couple years, our American Indian material may be back in the earth again, only to be dug up again by archaeologists in the next century, my guess is." He talked on as he walked. "Every group is so angry these days, they don't realize how much they're hurting themselves. If we don't learn from the dead, who do we learn from?" "Alex, you're singing to the choir," I said.
"Yeah, well, if it was my great-grandfather in one of these drawers," Marino retorted, "I'm not so sure I'd feel too good about that."
"But the point is, we don't know who is in these drawers, and neither do any of the people who are upset," said Vessi. "What we do know is that these specimens have helped us know a lot more about the diseases of the American Indian population, which is clearly a benefit to those now feeling threatened. Oh, well, don't get me started." Where Vessi worked was a series of small laboratory rooms that were a jumble of black counter space and sinks, and thousands of books and boxes of slides and professional journals. Displayed here and there were the usual shrunken heads and shattered skulls and various animal bones mistaken as human. On a cork board were large, painful photographs of the aftermath of Waco, where Vessi had spent weeks recovering and identifying the decomposing burned remains of Branch Davidians. "Let's see what you've got for me," Vessi said. I set my package on a counter and he slit the tape with a pocket knife. Styrofoam rattled as I dug out the cranium, then the very fragile lower portion of the skull that included the bones of the face. I set these on a clean blue cloth, and he turned on lamps and fetched a lens. "Right here," I directed him to the fine cut on bone. "It corresponds with hemorrhage in the temporal area, but around it the flesh was too burned for me to tell anything about what sort of injury we were dealing with. I didn't have a clue until I found this on the bone." "A very straight incision," he said, as he slowly turned the skull to look at it from different angles. "And we're certain this wasn't perhaps accidentally done during autopsy, when, for example, the scalp was reflected back to remove the skull cap?" "We're certain," I said. "And as you can see by putting the two together," I fit the cranium back in place, "the cut is about 1.5 inches below where the skull was opened during autopsy. And it's at an angle that would make no sense if one were reflecting back the scalp, see?" My index finger was suddenly huge as I looked through the lens and pointed. "This incision is vertical versus horizontal," I made my case. "You're right," he said, and his face was vibrant with interest. "As an artifact of autopsy, that would make no sense at all, unless your morgue assistant was drunk." "Could it be maybe some kind of defense injury?" Marino suggested. "You know, if someone was coming at her with a knife, they struggle and her face gets cut?" "Certainly that's possible," Vessi said, as he continued to process every millimeter of bone. "But I find it curious that this incision is so fine and exact, and it appears to be the same depth from one end to the other, which would be unusual if one is swinging a knife at someone. Generally, the cut to bone would be deeper where the blade struck first, and then more shallow as the blade traveled down." He demonstrated, an imaginary knife cutting straight down through air. "We also have to remember that a lot depends on the assailant's position in relation to the victim when she was cut," I commented. "Was the victim standing or lying down? Was the assailant in front or behind, or to one side of her or on top of her?" "Very true," said Vessi. He went to a dark oak cabinet with glass doors and lifted an old brown skull from a shelf. He carried it over to us and handed it to me, pointing to an obvious coarse cut in the left parietal and occipital area, or on the left side, high above the ear.
"You asked about scalpings," he said to me. "An 8 or 9-year-old, scalped, then burned. Can't tell the gender, but I know the poor kid had a foot infection, so he or she couldn't run. Cuts and nicks like this are fairly typical in scalpings."
I held the skull for a moment and imagined what Vessi had just said. I envisioned a cowering, crippled child, and blood running to the earth as his screaming people were massacred, and the camp went up in flames.
"Shit," Marino angrily muttered. "How do you do something like that to a kid?"
"How do you do something like that at all?" I said. Then to Vessi I added, "The cut on this," I pointed at the skull I had brought in, "would be unusual for a scalping." Vessi took a deep breath and slowly blew out.
"You know, Kay," he said, "it's never exact. It's whatever happened at the time. There were many ways that Indians scalped the enemy.
Usually the skin was incised in a circle over the skull down to the galea and periosteum, so it could be easily removed from the cranial vault. Some scalpings were simple. Others involved ears, eyes, the face, the neck. In some instances, multiple scalps were taken from the same victim, or maybe just the scalp lock or small area of the crown of the head was removed. Finally, and this is what you usually see in old westerns, the victim was violently grabbed by his hair, the skin sliced away with a knife or saber."
"Trophies," Marino said.
"That and the ultimate macho symbol of skill and bravery," said Vessi. "Of course, there were cultural, religious, and even medicinal motives as well. In your case," he added to me, "we know she wasn't successfully scalped because she still had her hair, and I can tell you the injury to bone strikes me as having been inflicted carefully with a very sharp instrument, a very sharp knife, maybe a razor blade or box cutter, or even something like a scalpel. It was inflicted while the victim was alive, and it was not the cause of death."
"No, her neck injury is what killed her," I agreed.
"I can find no other cuts, except possibly here."
He moved the lens closer to an area of the left zygomatic arch, or bone of the cheek.
"Something very faint," he muttered. "Too faint to be sure. See it?"
I leaned close to him to look.
"Maybe," I said.
"Almost like the thread of a spider web."
"Exactly. It's that faint.
And it may be nothing, but interestingly enough, it's positioned at very much the same angle as the other cut. Vertical versus horizontal or slanted."
"This is getting sick," Marino said ominously. "I mean, let's cut to the chase, no pun intended. What are we saying here? That some squirrel cut this lady's throat and then mutilated her face? And then torched the house?"
"I guess that's one possibility," Vessi said.
"Well, mutilating a face gets personal," Marino went on. "Unless you're dealing with a Looney Tune, you don't find killers mutilating the faces of victims they don't have some sort of connection with."
"As a rule, this is true," I agreed. "In my experience, where it hasn't been true is when the assailant is very disorganized and turns out to be psychotic."
"Whoever burned Sparks Farm was anything but disorganized, you ask me," Marino said.
"So you're contemplating that this might be a homicide of a more domestic nature," Vessi said, now slowly scanning the cranium with the lens.
"We have to contemplate everything," I said. "But if nothing else, when I try to imagine Sparks killing all his horses, I just can't see it."
"Maybe he had to kill them to get away with murder," Marino said, "so people would say what you just did."
"Alex," I said, "whoever did this to her made very sure we would never find a cut mark. And were it not for a glass door falling on top of her, there probably would have been virtually nothing of her left that would have given us any clue as to what happened. If we had recovered no tissue, for example, we wouldn't have known she was dead before the fire because we wouldn't be able to get a CO level. So what happens? She gets signed out as an accidental death, unless we prove arson, which so far we've been unable to do."
"There's no doubt in my mind that this is a classic case of fire used to disguise a homicide," Vessi said. Then why the hell hang around to cut on somebody? Marino said. Why not kill her and torch the joint and run like hell? And usually when these wackos mutilate, they get off on people seeing their handiwork. Hell, they display the bodies in a park, on a hillside, next to a road, on a jogging trail, in the middle of the living room, right there for all to see.
Maybe this person doesn't want us to see, I said. It's very important that we not know he left a signature this time, and I think we need to run as exhaustive a computer search as we can to see if anything even remotely similar to this has turned up anywhere else.
You do that and you bring in a lot of other people, Marino said. Programmers, analysts, guys who run the computers at the FBI and big police departments like Houston, L.A., and New York. I guarantee you someone's going to spill the beans and next thing this shit's all over the news.
Not necessarily, I said. It depends on who you ask. We caught a cab on Constitution and told the driver to head toward the White House and cut over to the 600 block of 15th Street. I intended to treat Marino to the old Ebbett Grill, and at 5:30 we did not have to wait in line but got a green velvet booth. I'd always found a special pleasure in the restaurant's stained glass, mirrors, and brass gas lamps wavering with flames. Turtles, boars, and antelopes were mounted over the bar, and the bartenders never seemed to slow down, no matter the time of day. A distinguished-looking couple behind us was talking about Kennedy Center tickets and their sons entering Harvard in the fall, while two young men debated whether lunch could go on the expense account. I parked my cardboard box next to me on the seat. Vessi had resealed it with yards of tape.
I guess we should have asked for a table for three, Marino said, looking at the box. You sure it doesn't stink? What if someone caught a whiff of it in here?
It doesn't stink, I said, opening my menu. And I think it would be wise to change the subject so we can eat. The burger here is so good that even I break down now and then and order it.
I'm looking at the fish, he said with great affectation. You ever had them here?
Go to hell, Marino.
All right, you talked me into it, Doc. Burger it is. I wish it were the end of the day so I could have a beer. It's torture to come to a joint like this and not have Jack Black or a tall one in a frosted mug. I bet they make mint juleps. I haven't had one of those since I was dating that girl from Kentucky, Sabrina. Remember her?
Maybe if you describe her, I absently said, as I looked around and tried to relax.
I used to bring her into the FOP. You was in there once with Benton, and I came over and introduced her. She had sort of reddish blonde hair, blue eyes, and pretty skin. She used to roller skate competitively.
I had no earthly idea who he was talking about.
Well, he was still studying the menu. It didn't last very long. I don't think she would have given me the time of day if it wasn't for my truck. When she was sitting high in that king cab, you would have thought she was waving at everybody from a float in the Rose Bowl parade.
I started laughing, and the blank expression on his face only made matters worse. I was laughing so hard my eyes were streaming, and the waiter paused and decided to come back later. Marino looked annoyed.
What's wrong with you? He said.
I guess I'm just tired, I said, gasping. And if you want a beer, you go right ahead. It's your day off, and I'm driving. This improved his mood dramatically, and not much later he was draining his first pint of Samuel Adams while his burger with Swiss and my chicken Caesar salad were served. For a while we ate and drifted in and out of a conversation while people around us talked loudly and nonstop.
I said, do you want to go away for your birthday? One businessman was telling another. You're used to going wherever you want. My wife's the same way, the other businessman replied as he chewed. Acts like I never take her anywhere. Hell, we go out to dinner almost every week.
I saw on Oprah that 1 out of 10 people owe more money than they can pay, an older woman confided to a companion whose straw hat was hanging from the hat rack by their booth. Isn't that wild? Doesn't surprise me in the least. It's like everything else these days.
They do have valet parking here, one of the businessmen said. But I usually walk. What about at night? Shoo. Are you kidding? In D.C.? Not unless you got a death wish.
I excused myself and went downstairs to the ladies' room, which was large and built of pale gray marble. No one else was there, and I helped myself to the handicap stall so I could enjoy plenty of space and wash my hands and face in private. I tried to call Lucy from my portable phone, but the signal seemed to bounce off walls and come right back. So I used a payphone and was thrilled to find her at home. "Are you packing?" I asked. "Can you hear an echo yet?" she said. Maybe." "Well, I can. You ought to see this place. Speaking of that, are you up for visitors?"
"Where are you?"
Her tone turned suspicious. "The old Ebbett Grill? At a payphone downstairs by the restrooms, to be exact. Marino and I were at the Smithsonian this morning seeing Vessi. I'd like to stop by. Not only to see you, but I have a professional matter to discuss."
"Sure,"
she said. "We're not going anywhere." "Can I bring anything?"
"Yeah, food."
There was no point in retrieving my car because Lucy lived in the northwest part of the city just off DuPont Circle, where parking would be as bad as it was everywhere else. Marino whistled for a cab outside the grill, and one slammed on its brakes and we got in. The afternoon was calm and flags were wilted over roofs and lawns, and somewhere a car alarm would not stop. We had to drive through George Washington University, past the Ritz and Blackie's Steakhouse to reach Lucy and Janet's neighborhood. The area was bohemian and mostly gay, with dark bars like The Fireplace and Mr. P's that were always crowded with well-built, body-pierced men. I knew because I had been here many times in the past to visit my niece, and I noted that the lesbian bookstore had moved, and there seemed to be a new health food store not too far from Burger King. "You can let us out here," I said to the driver. He slammed on the brakes again and swerved near the curb.
"Shit," Marino said as the blue cab raced away. "You think there are any Americans in this town?"
"If it wasn't for non-Americans in towns like this, you and I wouldn't be here," I reminded him.
"Being Italian's different."
"Really? Different from what?" I asked at the 2000 block of P Street, where we entered the DC Cafe.
"From them," he said. "For one thing, when our people got off the boat on Ellis Island, they learned to speak English. And they didn't drive taxicabs without knowing where the hell they was going. Hey, this place looks pretty good."
The cafe was open 24 hours a day, and the air was heavy with sautéing onions and beef. On the walls were posters of gyros, green teas, and Lebanese beer, and a framed newspaper article boasted that the Rolling Stones had once eaten here. A woman was slowly sweeping as if it were her mission in life. She paid us no mind. "You relax," I said to Marino. "This shouldn't take but a minute." He found a table to smoke while I went up to the counter and studied the yellow lit-up menu over the grill.
"Yes," said the cook, as he pressed sizzling beef and slapped and cut and tossed browning chopped onions.
"One Greek salad," I said, "and a chicken gyro in pita, and let me see," I perused. "I guess a kefta kebab sandwich? I guess that's how you say it."
"To go?"
"Yes."
"I call you," he said, as the woman swept.
I sat down with Marino. There was a TV, and he was watching Star Trek through a swarm of loud static.
"It's not going to be the same when she's in Philly," he said.
"It won't be." I stared numbly at the fuzzy form of Captain Kirk as he pointed his phaser at a Klingon or something.
"I don't know," he said, resting his chin in his hand as he blew out smoke. "Somehow it just don't seem right, Doc. She had everything all figured out and had worked hard to get it that way. I don't care what she says about her transferring. I don't think she wants to go. She just doesn't believe she's got a choice."
"I'm not sure she does if she wants to stay on the track she's chosen."
"Hell, I believe you always got a choice. You see an ashtray anywhere?"
I spotted one on the counter and carried it over. "I guess now I'm an accomplice," I said.
"You just nag me because it gives you something to do."
"Actually, I'd like you to hang around for a while, if that's all right with you," I said. "It seems I spend half my time trying to keep you alive."
"That's kind of an irony, considering how you spend the rest of your time, Doc." "Your order," the cook called out. "How about getting me a couple of those baklava things? The one with pistachios?"
"No," I said. 9. Lucy and Janet lived in a 10-story apartment building called the West Park that was in the 2000 block of P Street, a few minutes' walk away.
It was tan brick with a dry cleaner downstairs and the embassy mobile station next door. Bicycles were parked on small balconies, and young tenants were sitting out enjoying the balmy night, drinking and smoking, while someone practiced scales on a flute. A shirtless man reached out to shut his window. I buzzed apartment 503. "Who goes there?" Lucy's voice came over the intercom. "It's us," I said.
"Who's us?"
"The us with your dinner. It's getting cold," I said. The lock clicked free to let us into the lobby, and we took the elevator up.
"She could probably have a penthouse in Richmond for what she pays to live here," Marino commented.
"About $1,500 a month for a two-bedroom."
"Holy shit! How's Janet going to make it alone? The Bureau can't be paying her more than $40,000.
"Her family has money," I said. "Other than that, I don't know."
"I tell you, I wouldn't want to be starting out these days."
He shook his head as elevator doors parted.
"Now, back in Jersey, when I was just revving up my engines, $1,500 could have kept me in clover for a year. Crime wasn't like it is, and people were nicer, even in my badass neighborhood. And here we are, you and yours truly, working on some poor lady who was all cut up and burned in a fire, and after we finish with her, it will be somebody else. It's like what's-his-name rolling that big rock up the hill, and every time he gets close, down it rolls again. I swear, I wonder why we bother, Doc."
"Because it would be worse if we didn't," I said, stopping before the familiar pale orange door and ringing the bell. I could hear the deadbolt flip open, and then Janet was letting us in. She was sweating in FBI running shorts and a Grateful Dead T-shirt that looked left over from college. "Come in," she said with a smile, as Annie Lennox played loudly in the background. "Something smells good." The apartment was two bedrooms and two baths, forced into a very tight space that overlooked P Street. Every piece of furniture was stacked with books and layered with clothing, and dozens of boxes were on the floor. Lucy was in the kitchen, rattling around in cupboards and drawers as she gathered silverware and plates and paper towels for napkins. She cleared a space on the coffee table and took the bags of food from me. "You just saved our lives," she said to me. "I was getting hypoglycemic. And by the way, Pete, nice to see you too."
"Damn, it's hot in here," he said.
"It's not so bad," Lucy said, and she was sweating too. She and Janet filled their plates. They sat on the floor and ate while I propped up on an armrest of the couch, and Marino carried in a plastic chair from the balcony. Lucy was in Nike running shorts and a tank top, and dirty from head to heel. Both young women looked exhausted, and I could not imagine what they were feeling. Surely this was an awful time for them. Every emptying of a drawer and taping shut a box had to be another blow to the heart, a death, an end to who you were at that time in your life. "The two of you have lived here, what, 3 years?" I asked.
"Close to it," said Janet as she speared a forkful of Greek salad.
"And you'll stay in this same apartment?" I said to Janet.
"For the time being. There's really no reason to move, and when Lucy pops in and out, she'll have some room."
"I hate to bring up an unpleasant subject," Marino said, "but is there any reason Carrie might know where you guys live?" There was silence for a moment as both women ate. I reached over to the CD player to turn down the volume.
"Reason?" Lucy finally spoke.
"Why would there be a reason for her to know anything about my life these days?"
"Hopefully there's no reason at all," Marino said. "But we got to think about it whether you two birds like it or not. This is the sort of neighborhood she would hang in and fit right in, so I'm asking myself, if I was Carrie and back out on the street, would I want to find where Lucy is?"
No one said a word.
"And I think we all know what the answer is," he went on. "Now, finding where the doc lives is no big problem. It's been in the newspapers enough, and if you find her, you find Benton. But you?" He pointed at Lucy. "You're the challenge, because Carrie'd been locked up for several years by the time you moved here. And now you're moving to Philly, and Janet's left here alone. And to be honest, I don't like that worth a damn either."
"Neither of you is listed in the phone book, right?" I asked.
"No way," Janet said, and she was listlessly picking at her salad.
"What if someone called this building and asked for either of you?"
"They're not supposed to give out info like that," Janet said. "Not supposed to," Marino sardonically said. Yeah, I'm sure this joint's got state-of-the-art security. Must be all kinds of high-profile people living here, huh?
We can't sit around worrying about this all of the time, Lucy said, and she was getting angry. Can't we talk about something else?
Let's talk about the Warrington fire, I said.
Let's do.
I'll be packing in the other room, Janet appropriately said, since she was FBI and not involved in this case. I watched her disappear into a bedroom, and then I said, there were some unusual and disturbing findings during the autopsy. The victim was murdered. She was dead before the fire started, which certainly points at arson. Have we made any further headway on how the fire might have been set?
Only through algebra, Lucy said. The only hope here is fire modeling, since there's no physical evidence that points at arson, only circumstantial evidence. I've spent a lot of time fooling around with fire simulator on my computer, and the predictions keep coming back to the same thing.
What the hell is fire simulator? Marino wanted to know.
One of the routines in FPE tool, the software we use for fire modeling, Lucy patiently explained. For example, we'll assume that flashover is reached at 600 degrees Celsius, or 1,112 degrees Fahrenheit. So we plug in the data we know, such as the vent opening, area of surface, energy available from the fuel, fire virtual point of origin, room lining materials, wall materials, and so on and so on. And at the end of the day, we should get good predictions as to the suspect, or the fire in question. And guess what? No matter how many algorithms, procedures, or computer programs you try with this one, the answer's always the same. There's no logical explanation for how a fire this fast and hot could have started in the master bathroom.
And we're absolutely sure it did, I said.
Oh, yeah, Lucy said. As you probably know, that bathroom was a relatively modern addition built out from the master bedroom. And if you look at the marble walls, the cathedral ceiling we recovered, you can piece together this really narrow, sharply defined V pattern with the apex pointing somewhere in the middle of the floor, most likely where the rug was, meaning the fire developed really fast and hot in that one spot.
Let's talk about this famous rug, Marino said. You light it, and what kind of fire do we get?
A lazy flame, Lucy answered. Maybe 2 feet tall.
Well, that didn't do it, I said.
And what's also really telling, she went on, is the destruction to the roof directly above. Now we're talking flames at least 8 feet high above the fire's origin, with the temperature reaching about 1,800 degrees for the glass in the skylight to melt. About 88% of all arsons are up from the floor. In other words, the radiant heat flux.
What the hell's radiant flux? Marino wanted to know.
Radiant heat is in the form of an electromagnetic wave and is emitted from a flame almost equally in all directions, 360 degrees. Following me so far?
Okay, I said.
A flame also emits heat in the form of hot gases, which weigh less than air, so up they go, Lucy the physicist went on. A convective transfer of heat, in other words. And in the early stages of the fire, most of the heat transfer is convective. It moves up from its point of origin, in this case, the floor. But after the fire was going for a while and hot gas smoke layers formed, the dominant form of heat transfer became radiant. It was at this stage that I think the shower door fatigued and fell on top of the body.
And what about the body? I asked.
Where would that have been during all this? Lucy grabbed a legal pad off the top of a box and clicked open a pen. She drew the outline of a room with a tub and shower, and in the middle of the floor, a tall, narrow fire that was impinging upon the ceiling. If the fire was energetic enough to project flames to the ceiling, then we're talking about a high radiant flux. The body was going to be severely damaged unless there was a barrier between it and the fire, something that absorbed radiant heat and energy, the tub and shower door, which would have protected areas of the body. I also think the body was at least some small distance from the point of origin. We could be talking feet, maybe a yard or two.
I don't see any other way it could have happened, I agreed.
Clearly something protected much of it.
Right.
How the hell do you set off a torch like that without some sort of accelerant? Marino asked.
All we can hope is that something turns up in the labs, my niece said. You know, since the fuel load can't account for the observed fire pattern, then something was added or modified indicating arson. "And you guys are working on a financial audit," Marino said to her. Naturally, almost all of Spark's records burned up in the fire, but his financial people and accountant have been pretty helpful to give the guy credit. So far, there's no indication that money was a problem.
I was relieved to hear it. Everything I knew about this case so far argued against Kenneth Sparks being anything but a victim. But this was not an opinion that was shared by most, I felt sure.
"Lucy," I said as she finished her gyropeda, "I think we're all in agreement that the M.O. of this crime is distinctive. Definitely. Let's just suppose," I went on, "for the sake of argument, that something similar has happened before, somewhere else. That Warrenton is simply part of a pattern of fires used to disguise homicides that are being committed by the same individual."
"It's certainly possible," Lucy said. "Anything is."
"Can we do a search?" I then asked. "Is there any database that might connect similar MOs in fires?" She got up and threw food containers in a large trash bag in the kitchen.
"You want to, we can," she said.
"With the arson incident system, or AXIS." I was well acquainted with it and the new supersonic ATF wide-area computer network called ESA, which was an acronym for Enterprise System Architecture, the result of ATF being mandated by Congress to create a national arson and explosive repository. 220 sites were hooked up to ESA, and any agent, no matter where he was, could access the central database, could pipe himself into AXIS with his laptop, as long as he had a modem or a secure cellular line. This included my niece. She led us back to her tiny bedroom, which was now depressingly bare save for cobwebs in corners and dust balls on the scuffed hardwood floor. The box springs were empty, the mattress still made with wrinkled peach sheets and upended against a wall, and rolled up in a corner was the colorful silk rug that I had given her for her last birthday. Empty dresser drawers were stacked on the floor. Her office was a Panasonic laptop on top of a cardboard box. The portable computer was in a shark gray steel and magnesium case that met military specifications for being ruggedized, meaning it was vapor-proof and dust-proof and everything-proof, and supposedly could be dropped and run over by a Humvee. Lucy sat before it on the floor, Indian style, as if she were about to worship the great god of technology. She hit the enter key to turn the screensaver off, and ESA lit up rows of pixels at a time in electric blue, flashing a map of the United States on the next vivid screen. At a prompt, she typed in her username and password, answered other secure prompts to work her way into the system, invisibly cruising through secret gateways on the web, passing through one level at a time. When she had logged on to the case repository, she motioned for me to sit next to her.
"I can get you a chair if you want," she said.
"No, this is fine." The floor was hard and unkind to my lower lumbar spine, but I was a good sport. A prompt asked her to enter a word or words or phrases that she wished the system to search for throughout the database.
"Don't worry about the format," Lucy said.
"The text search engines can handle complete stream of consciousness. We can try everything from the size of the fire hose used to the materials the house was made of. All that fire safety info and stuff that's in your set forms fire departments fill out. Or you can go with your own key queries."
"Let's try death, homicide, suspected arson," I said.
"Female," Marino added, "and wealth."
"Cut, incision, hemorrhage, fast, hot," I continued thinking.
"What about unidentified?" Lucy said as she typed.
"Good," I said.
"And bathroom, I suppose."
"Hell, put horses in there," Marino said.
"Let's go ahead and give it a shot," Lucy proposed. "We can always try more words as we think of them." She executed a search and then stretched her legs out and rolled her neck. I could hear Janet in the kitchen washing dishes, and in less than a minute, the computer came back with 11,873 records searched and 453 keywords found.
"That's since 1988, Lucy let us know. "And that also includes any cases from overseas in which ATF was called in to assist."
"Can we print out the 453 records?" I asked.
"You know the printer's packed, Aunt Kay," Lucy looked up apologetically at me.
Then how about downloading the records to my computer? I said. She looked uncertain.
I guess that's all right, she said. As long as you make sure... Oh, never mind.
Don't worry, I'm used to confidential information. I'll make sure no one else gets hold of them.
I knew it was stupid when I said it.
Lucy stared longingly into the computer screen. This whole thing's Unix-based SQL. She seemed to be talking to no one. Makes me crazy.
Well, if they had a brain in their head, they'd have you here doing their computer shit, Marino said.
I haven't made an issue of it, Lucy replied. I'm trying to pay my dues. I'll ship those files to you, Aunt Kay. She walked out of the room. We followed her into the kitchen, where Janet was rolling glasses in newspaper and carefully packing them into a store-all box.
Before I head out, I said to my niece, could we maybe go for a walk around the block or something, and just catch up?
She gave me a look that was something less than trustful.
What? She said.
I may not see you again for a while, I said.
We can sit out on the porch.
That would be fine.
We chose white plastic chairs in the open air above the street, and I shut the sliders behind us and watched crowds come alive at night. Taxis were not stopping, and the fireplace in the window of the flame danced behind glass while men drank in the dark with each other.
I just want to know how you are, I said to her. I don't feel like you talk to me much.
Ditto.
She stared out with a wry smile, her profile striking and strong.
I'm all right, Lucy. As all right as I ever am, I guess. Too much work.
What else has changed?
You always worry about me.
I have since you were born.
Why?
Because somebody should.
Did I tell you Mother's getting a facelift?
Just the thought of my only sibling made my heart turn hard.
She had half her teeth crowned last year. Now this, Lucy went on. Her current boyfriend, Beau, has hung in there for almost a year and a half. How about that?
How many times can you screw before you need something else nipped and tucked?
Lucy.
Oh, don't be self-righteous, Aunt Kay. You feel the same way about her that I do. How did I end up with such a piece of shit for a mother?
This isn't helping you in the least, I quietly said. Don't hate her, Lucy.
She hasn't said one fucking word about my moving to Philadelphia. She never asks about Janet, or you for that matter.
I'm getting a beer. Do you want one?
Help yourself.
I waited for her in the growing dark, watching the shapes of people flow by, some loud and holding on to each other, while others moved with purpose alone. I wanted to ask Lucy about what Janet had told me, but I was afraid to bring it up. Lucy should tell me on her own, I reminded myself, as my physician's voice ordered that I should take control. Lucy popped open a bottle of Miller Lite as she returned to the balcony.
So let's talk about Carrie just long enough for you to put your mind at ease, Lucy matter-of-factly stated, taking a swallow. I have a Browning high power and my SIG from ATF and a shotgun, 12-gauge, 7 rounds. You name it, I can get it. But you know, I think my bare hands would be enough if she dared to come around. I've had enough, you know.
She lifted the bottle again.
Eventually, you just make a decision and move on.
What sort of decision? I asked.
She shrugged. You decide you can't give someone any more power than you already have. You can't spend your days in fear of them or hating them, she explained her mindset. So you give it up, in a sense. You go about your business, knowing that if the monster ever steps into your path, she'd better be ready for life or death.
I think that's a pretty good attitude, I said.
Maybe the only attitude. I'm just not sure you really feel that way, but I hope so.
She stared up at an irregular moon, and I thought she was blinking back tears, but I couldn't be sure.
The truth is, Aunt Kay, I could do all their computer stuff with one arm, you know?
You could probably do all the Pentagon's computer stuff with one arm, I gently said as my heart hurt more.
I just don't want to push it.
I did not know how to answer her.
I pissed off enough people because I can fly a helicopter and, well, you know.
I know all the things you can do, and that the list will probably only grow longer, Lucy. It's very lonely being you.
Have you ever felt like that? She whispered.
Only all my life,
I whispered back. And now you know why I've always loved you the way I do. Maybe I get it.
She looked over at me. She reached out and sweetly touched my wrist.
You'd better go, she said. I don't want you driving when you're tired.
10. It was almost midnight when I slowed at the guard booth in my neighborhood and the security officer on duty stepped out to stop me. This was highly unusual, and I feared he would tell me that my burglar alarm had been going half the night, or yet one more oddball had tried to drive through to see if I was at home. Marino had been dozing for the past hour and a half, and he came too as I rolled down my window.
"Good evening," I said to the guard. "How are you doing, Tom?"
"I'm fine, Dr. Scarpetta," he said, leaning close to my car. "But you've had a few unusual events within the past hour or so, and I figured something wasn't right when I kept trying to reach you and you weren't home."
"What sort of events?" I asked, as I began to imagine any number of threatening things.
"Two pizza delivery guys showed up at almost the same time. Then three taxis came to take you to the airport, one right after the other. And someone tried to deliver a construction dumpster to your yard. When I couldn't get hold of you, I turned every one of them around. They all said you had called them."
"Well, I certainly did not," I said with feeling, as my bewilderment grew. "All this since when?"
"Well, I guess the truck with the dumpster was here maybe around 5 this afternoon. Everything else since then."
Tom was an old man who probably wouldn't have had a clue as to how to defend the neighborhood should true danger ever come around the bend. But he was courteous and considered himself a true officer of the law, and in his mind was probably armed and experienced in combat. He was especially protective of me.
"Did you get the names of any of these guys who showed up?" Marino loudly asked from the passenger seat. "Domino's and Pizza Hut."
Tom's animated face was shadowed beneath the brim of his baseball cap.
"And the cabs were Colonial, Metro, and Yellow Cab. The construction company was Frick. Now, I took the liberty to make a few calls. Every one of them had orders in your name, Dr. Scarpetta, including the times you called. I got it written down."
Tom could not hide how pleased he was when he slipped a square of notepaper from a back pocket and handed it to me. His role had been more than the usual this night, and he was almost intoxicated by it. I turned on the interior light, and Marino and I scanned the list. The taxi and pizza orders had been placed between 10:10 and 11, while the dumpster order had been placed earlier in the afternoon, with instructions for a late afternoon delivery.
"I know at least Domino said it was a woman who called. I talked to the dispatcher myself, a young kid. According to him, you called and said to just bring a large, thick-crust pizza supreme to the gate, and you'd get it from there. I got his name written down, too," Tom reported with great pride. "So none of this came from you, Dr. Scarpetta?"
He wanted to make sure.
"No, sir," I answered. "And if anything else shows up tonight, I want you to call me right away."
"Yo, call me, too," said Marino,
and he jotted his home number on a business card.
"I don't give a shit what time it is."
I handed Marino's card out my window, and Tom looked carefully at it, even though Marino had passed through these gates more times than I could guess.
"You got it, Captain," Tom said with a deep nod. "Yes, sir. Anybody else shows up, I'm on the horn, and I can hold 'em till you get here if you want me to." "Don't do that," Marino said. "Some kid with a pizza's not going to know a damn thing. And if it's real trouble, I don't want you tangling with whoever it is."
I knew right then that he was thinking about Carrie.
"I'm pretty spry, but you got it, Captain."
"You did a great job, Tom," I complimented him. "I can't thank you enough."
"That's what I'm here for."
He pointed his remote control and raised the arm to let us through.
"I'm listening," I said to Marino.
"Some asshole harassing you," he said, his face grim in the intermittent bath of street lamps. "Trying to upset you, scare you, piss you off, and doing a pretty damn good job, I might add."
"You don't think Carrie..." I went ahead and started to say.
"I don't know," Marino cut me off. "But it wouldn't surprise me. Your neighborhood's been in the news enough times.
I guess what would be good to know is if the orders were placed locally, I said.
Christ, he said as I turned into my driveway and parked behind his car. I sure as hell hope not. Unless it's someone else who's jerking you around.
Take a number and stand in line.
I cut the engine. I can sleep on your couch if you want me to, Marino said as he opened his door.
Of course not, I said. I'll be fine. As long as no construction dumpsters show up, that would be the last straw with my neighbors.
I don't know why you live here anyway.
Yes, you do. He got out a cigarette and clearly did not want to go anywhere.
Right. The card booth. Shit. Talk about a placebo.
If you don't feel okay to drive, I'd be pleased to have you stay on my couch, I said.
Who, me?
He fired his lighter and puffed smoke out the open car door.
It ain't me I'm worried about, Doc.
I got out of my car and stood on the driveway waiting for him. His shape was big and tired in the dark, and I suddenly was overwhelmed by sad affection for him. Marino was alone and probably felt like hell. He couldn't have memories worth much between violence on the job and bad relationships the rest of the time. I supposed I was the only constant in his life, and although I was usually polite, I wasn't always warm. It simply wasn't possible. Come on, I said. I'll fix you a toddy and you can crash here.
You're right.
Maybe I don't want to be alone and have five more pizza deliveries and cabs show up.
That's what I'm thinking, he said, with feigned cool professionalism.
I unlocked my front door and turned off the alarm, and very shortly Marino was on the wraparound couch in my great room with a Booker's bourbon on the rocks. I made his nest with sweet-smelling sheets and a baby-soft cotton blanket, and for a while we sat in the dark talking.
You ever think we might lose in the end? He sleepily muttered.
Lose? I asked.
You know, good guys always win. How realistic is that? Not so for other people, like that lady that burned up in Sparks' house. Good guys don't always win. Doc. No fucking way.
He halfway sat up like a sick man and took a swallow of bourbon and struggled for breath.
Carrie thinks she's gonna win, too, in case that thought's never entered your mind, he added. She's had 5 fucking years at Kirby to think that.
Whenever Marino was tired or half-drunk, he said fuck a lot. In truth, it was a grand word that expressed what one felt by the very act of saying it. But I had explained to him many times before that not everyone could deal with its vulgarity, and for that matter, some perhaps took it all too literally. I personally never thought of fuck as sexual intercourse, but rather of wishing to make a point. I can't entertain the thought that people like her will win, I quietly said as I sipped red burgundy. I will never think that.
Pie in the sky.
No, Marino. Faith.
Yo. He swallowed more bourbon. Fucking faith. You know how many guys I've known to drop dead of heart attacks or get killed on the job? How many of them do you think had faith? Probably every goddamn one of them. Nobody thinks they're gonna die, Doc. You and me don't think it, no matter how much we know. My health sucks, okay? You think I don't know I'm taking a bite of a poison cookie every day? Can I help it? Nah. I'm just an old slob who has to have his steak biscuits and whiskey and beer. I've given up giving a shit about what the doctors say. So soon enough, I'm gonna stoop over in the saddle and be out of here, you know?
His voice was getting husky and he was beginning to get maudlin.
So a bunch of cops will come to my funeral and you'll tell the next detective to come along how it wasn't all that bad to work with me.
Marino, go to sleep, I said. And you know that's not how I feel at all. I can't even think of something happening to you, you big idiot.
You really mean that?
He brightened a bit.
You know damn well I do, I said, and I was exhausted too.
He finished his bourbon and softly rattled the ice in the glass, but I didn't respond because he'd had enough.
Know what, Doc? He thickly said. I like you a lot, even if you are a pain in the fucking ass.
Thank you, I said. I'll see you in the morning.
It is morning.
He rattled ice some more.
Go to sleep, I said. I did not turn off my bedside lamp until 2 a.m., and thank God it was Fielding's turn to spend Saturday in the morgue. It was almost 9 when I got motivated to put my feet on the floor, and birds were raucous in my garden, and the sun was bouncing light off the world like a manic child with a ball. My kitchen was so bright it was almost white, and stainless steel appliances were like mirrors. I made coffee and did what I could to clear my head as I thought of the files downloaded into my computer. I thought of opening sliders and windows to enjoy spring air, and then Carrie's face was before me again. I went into the great room to check on Marino. He slept the way he lived, struggling against his physical existence as if it were the enemy, the blanket kicked practically to the middle of the floor, pillows beaten into shape, and sheets twisted around his legs. "Good morning," I said. "Not yet," he mumbled. He turned over and punched the pillow into submission under his head. He wore blue boxer shorts and an undershirt that stopped 6 inches short of covering his swollen belly, and I always marveled that men were not shy about fat the way women were. In my own way, I very much cared about staying in shape, and when my clothes started feeling tight around the waist, both my general disposition and libido turned much less agreeable. "You can sleep a few more minutes," I said to him. I gathered up the blanket and spread it across him. He resumed snoring like a wounded wild boar, and I moved to the kitchen table and called Benton at his New York hotel. "I hope I didn't wake you," I said. "Actually, I was almost out the door. How are you?" He was warm but distracted. "I'd be better if you were here and she were back behind bars. The problem is, I know her patterns, and she knows I know them, so I may as well not know them, if you see what I mean," he said, in that controlled tone that meant he was angry. "Last night, several of us disguised ourselves as homeless people and went down into the tunnels in the Bowery. A lovely way to spend the evening, I might add. We revisited the spot where Galt was killed." Benton was always very careful to say "where Galt was killed" instead of "where you killed Galt." "I am convinced she's gone back there and will again," he went on. "And not because she misses him, but that any reminder of the violent crimes they committed together excites her. The thought of his blood excites her. For her it's a sexual high, a power rush that she's addicted to, and you and I both know what that means, Kay. She'll need a fix soon, if she hasn't already gotten one that we just haven't found out about yet. I'm sorry to be a doomsayer, but I have a gut feeling that whatever she does is going to be far worse than what she did before." "It's hard to imagine anything could be worse than that," I said, though I really did not mean it. Whenever I had thought that human beings could get no worse, they did. Or perhaps it was simply that primitive evil seemed more shocking in a civilization of highly evolved humans who traveled to Mars and communicated through cyberspace. "And so far no sign of her," I said. "Not even a hint." "We've gotten hundreds of leads going nowhere. NYPD's set up a special task force, as you know, and there's a command center with guys taking calls 24 hours a day."
"How much longer will you stay up there?"
"Don't know."
"Well, I'm sure if she's still in the area, she knows damn well where you are. The New York Athletic Club, where you always stay. Just 2 buildings from where she and Galt had a room back then." I was upset again. "I guess that's the Bureau's idea of sticking you in a shark cage and waiting for her to come and get it."
"A good analogy," he said. "Let's hope it works."
"And what if it does?" I said, as fear cut through my blood and made me angrier. "I wish you'd come home and let the FBI do its job. I can't get over it. You retire and they don't give you the time of day until they want to use you for bait."
"Kay, how can you let them use you?" "It's not like that. This is my choice, a job I have to finish. She was my case from the start, and as far as I'm concerned, she still is. I can't just relax at the beach knowing she's loose and going to kill again. How can I just look the other way when you, Lucy, Marino, when all of us are very possibly in danger?"
"Benton, don't turn into a Captain Ahab, okay? Don't let this become your obsession. Please." He laughed. "Take me seriously, goddammit."
"I promise I'll stay away from white whales."
"You're already chasing the hell out of one."
"I love you, Kay."
As I followed the hallway to my office, I wondered why I bothered saying the same old words to him. I knew his behavior almost as well as I knew my own, and the idea that he wouldn't be doing exactly what he was right now was about as unthinkable as my letting another forensic pathologist take over the Warrington case because it was my right to take it easy at this stage in my life.
This book is continued on Disc 6.